Welcome to week three of Business Communications. My name is Stu Schlackman and glad to have you today. Today what we're going to be talking about is messages, and we're going to talk about routine messages, persuasive requests, and bad messages, actually bad news messages. So the first one is, if you would, and what I'm going to be referencing is pages 232 through 238 in your textbook. Bottom line is, when it comes to routine messages, you always want to give good news first. If there's good news, that's the first thing you want to convey, because whatever a decision is, people are waiting for that. Give you an example on page 233, what not to do. Although we do not generally provide the type of information you requested, we have decided to do so in this case. So what they're doing there is waiting till the last part of the sentence to let you know that they decide to do so. What you want to say is, right off the bat, we are happy to provide the information you requested. So what we want to do is get straight to the point and always give good news first. Now, if you turn to actually page 237, and there what we have is kind of the checklist of routine requests and routine replies. Always present the major request in the first one or two sentences, just so the people know where they're at. It's like if you have a request for proposal, a lot of times if the price is the most important thing to somebody, you want to put that up front and not string it along to the end. People want their information as soon as possible. And what we want to do is always provide a reasoning or an explanation to why we say yes or no to a request, and phrase each question so that it's clear, easy to answer, and covers only one topic. It's just like if I was to ask you a question, it's just a lot clearer for me to ask you one question than to bombard you with five at one time. You'd be confused and wouldn't even know where to start. And if it's appropriate, incorporate the reader benefits and promise confidentiality. Now, routine replies, always answer promptly, graciously, grant the request, or begin giving the request, the requested information, in the first sentence or two. And if it's a yes answer, we want to let them know that right up front. And also refer to any items you enclose with the letter, you know, like brochures or statistics or anything like that. And we always want to close on a positive note, a friendly note. We want to always thank people for doing business with us, for inquiring with us about the potential of doing business. Okay, now if you would do me a favor and turn to page 266 in your textbook, we're going to be looking at a persuasive message. And persuasion typically has to be done to overcome some sort of a resistance that people have to what you're trying to accomplish. And the purpose of persuasion is to motivate the reader to agree with what you're trying to get them to do. And if you're not clear about the specific results you want to achieve, you won't be able to plan an effective strategy to help you get the goals that you're trying to get. One thing you'd need to know, and this is very common in negotiation skills training, is that knowledge is power. The more knowledge you have about the person you're dealing with, about their needs, their wants, their desires, the better you could write effectively and position, you know, your ideas, your products, or your services. Things you need to know. Are there competing proposals on the table? Are they looking at somebody else? Okay, what are the implications for the organization? What are the issues they're having? Does your proposal meet what they're trying to accomplish? And how does your proposal fit in with the existing plans that they're trying to do? What we want to do is understand who our audience is. What are the characteristics of the audience? Are they older, younger? Are they more traditional, conservative? Are they more risk takers? Okay, and most important thing is, what are their needs? What are they trying to accomplish? What are their goals and objectives? And how can you meet them? So as we're writing, a persuasive message, we got to, in a way, sell them on our ideas and concepts. Give you an example of that on page 268, what not to do. The San Diego Accounting Society would like you to speak to us on the topic of expensing versus capitalizing 401c assets. Sounds pretty boring to me. The way you want to approach this is speaking to the San Diego Accounting Society would enable you to present your firm's views on the controversial topic of expensing versus capitalizing 401c assets. So in a way, they're selling you, this would enable you to present your firm's views. That's a much better way of approaching the topic. Now, when you take a look at organizing a persuasive request, there's a couple of approaches. There's the direct plan, which is what you want to do is present your major idea first. And give you an example, and this is on page 269, what not to do. I recommend we hold our Pittsburgh sales meeting at the Mark Congress Hotel. Okay, what's the reason for that? Why do they suggest that? What you want to say is, I have evaluated 3 hotels as possible meeting sites for our Pittsburgh sales conference and recommend we meet at the Mark Congress Hotel. As discussed below, the Mark Congress is centrally located, has the best meeting facilities, and is moderately priced. Now, those are good reasons, and that becomes a persuasive request to sell the person on why we should have the meeting at the Mark Congress Hotel. So, in general, on direct communication, you're writing to superiors within the organization, or your audience is predisposed to listen objectively. The proposal does not require strong persuasion, and the proposal is long or complex, or you know that your reader prefers the direct approach. And that's when we want to apply the direct approach. Now also, there is the indirect plan. And the indirect plan is basically one where what you want to do is first get the attention of the reader. And that's done a lot with marketing. And also, one effective way is with an opening sentence is to open it with a rhetorical question. Give you some examples of what not to do and what to do on page 270. Not to do. How would you like to save our department $7,500 yearly? What you want to say is, what do you think the labor costs are for changing just one light bulb? $10? $25? More? See, there's more of a need, or it becomes more inquisitive. Well, tell me more about that. Who wouldn't want to save $7,500 a year? And the next one is what not to do. Did you know that the Hartford Community Fund is more than 75 years old? And my answer to that would be, so what? But what you want to say is, what do Paul Newman and the Hartford Community Fund have in common? Well, they're both 75 years old, but I'd be interested in just hearing more about, well, gee, what is, how does Paul Newman have something in common with the Hartford Community Fund? So what you want to do, we want to create interest and justify our requests. Another example of this would be on page 271, what not to do. Locating our plant in Suffolk instead of in Norfolk would result in considerable savings. Well, my question to that was, how so? How much savings? Can you quantify it? I'm not really sure what they're talking about. What you want to say is, locating our plant in Suffolk instead of in Norfolk would result in an annual savings of nearly $175,000, and shown in table 3. Now we're quantifying it. Now I see a substantial savings, and now I'm interested in reading on further, and I could be persuaded. Okay, typical things that help in persuasion. Facts and statistics. You should know that 43% of all statistics are made up on the spot, and that's a lie right there. But facts and statistics justify what you're trying to accomplish. Also, testimonials. On my website, which is Competitive Excellence, I have a testimonial page, and right now I believe I have like 26 testimonials from folks that have gone through my training, and what they say is what it has done for them. In one such case, one of the presidents of an insurance company actually said that last year revenues went up 24.2% and new business went up 35%, and all the salespeople went through the workshop. So that is just an excellent statistic that helps me persuade or justify people that taking my course is a major advantage to your business environment. So, taking a look at, actually, on page 272, dealing with obstacles, and what I like to call obstacles is objections. That's when there's resistance, that when somebody does not agree to do what you want them to do, or they're not buying a product or a service, what do you do? And there are two types of objections, I like to call them, and they are a factual objection and an emotional objection, and you won't find this in the textbook. But basically, a factual objection is one where, well, your price is too high. I have $100 to spend, and your price is $200. Well, that's a fact. What do you do? Well, what I like to do is when we're trying to persuade someone, we want to ask them, when buying something or making a decision, what is the most important thing to you? And typically what is of most importance to them is what we need to redirect them back to. And sometimes that's more difficult to do, but a factual objection is not one you could get around. You have to refocus them, redirect them back to the whole reason you're talking to them in the first place. I'll give you an example. If you're buying a car and the car costs $20,000 and you only have $17,000 in your budget, but the most important thing to you was to get a hybrid that would get 35 miles to the gallon. The most important thing to you is 35 miles to the gallon. Even though you only have $17,000 to spend, we want to refocus or redirect back to the point that the most important thing is to get a hybrid. And by the way, all hybrids are in this price range, so let's look at other financial options to get you the car that you really want to get. So that's how you redirect. Now, emotional is one where you have to clarify or prove, and that's where you could clarify or prove with statistics, with reference letters and things like that. Something like, well, I heard that the service at this dealership is pretty poor. Well, let me let you talk to a few of my customers. Or we heard that this type of car breaks down a lot. Well, let us show you some facts and statistics on the servicing of this car, and when we see typically when brakes will fail or have to be replaced, or engines, etc. So two types of objections, factual and emotional. But the bottom line is what we always want to do is we want to write a persuasive message that will be a call to action to get someone to say yes to what you're trying to propose. And that's the most important thing. Next, let's go to pages 282 through 284. And this is gaining the reader's attention on page 282. Two types of letters. A solicited letter, which is basically a reply to a request for product information, and an unsolicited sales letter, on the other hand, is a letter, just promoting your company's products or services, that is a blanket mail out to potential customers. And as you know, in reality, we get a lot of unsolicited mail every day of our lives, especially on getting new credit cards, and we just typically rip them apart and throw them in the mail. I mean, in the garbage. So how effective are unsolicited sales letters? My opinion, not at all. But if someone is asking you for a request, that's a great opportunity to let them know why they should make a decision to go with you. And at the bottom of the page, techniques, the following types of open sentences have proven effective for sales letters. The rhetorical question, what is the difference between extravagance and luxury, or thought-provoking statement, or an unusual fact? In fact, I like to start out some of my sermons with statistics or a rhetorical question or an unusual fact. What we want to do is immediately get their attention up front. So, next page, page 283, is creating interest. An example of what not to do at the bottom, Masco binoculars zoom from 3 to 12 power. And my answer to that would be, so what? What does that mean to me? What's the benefit? But the right way to do it is to say, with Masco binoculars, you can look a ruby-throated hummingbird squarely in the eye at 300 feet and see it blink. Now, that's pretty impressive. Now, I'm not sure what I would use that for, but maybe I would use it if I was hunting. But that's an example of how you might be able to build desire or create interest. But the way to do it is to understand what the needs of the client is, or the needs of somebody within your organization. Meeting their needs becomes of value to them, and value is always a benefit. Another example, using vivid language on 284, what not to do. The paper tray is designed to hold 200 sheets. I really don't care about that. But on the next one, what to do. The paper tray holds 200 sheets, enough to last the busy executive a full week without reloading. There's a benefit to me. I'm saving time. There's more convenience in that. Using objective ethical language, what not to do. At $595, the Sherwood Moped is the best buy on the... I'm sorry. The Sherwood Moped is the best buy on the market. Well, that's not really ethical. What is the May 2004 independent consumer rated the $595 Sherwood Moped the year's best buy. So that's ethical. It's objective. You're using an independent consumer rated report that really is unbiased. Another thing you want to do is focus on the central theme, the central selling theme. Okay, what is the recurring message that you want to convey to the person? And we want to just continually emphasize that. For instance, is price what you lead with? Is that the most important thing that sets you apart from all your competition? Then that's what you want to convey the most often. And also referring to enclosures, some of the features of a product or services are best displayed in a brochure that you can enclose with a sales letter. So sometimes we want to enclose brochures when we send something out. Another example of what not to do on page 286, I have enclosed a sales brochure on this product, but what you want to say is note the porcelain robin's detailed coloring on the actual size photograph on page 2 of the enclosed brochure. What you're doing there is getting them to take action. And that's what we want to do, is stimulate interest in the eyes of whoever we're conveying a message to, whether it's somebody within our own organization, or it's a client, or a potential client. Let's go ahead, and what we'll do is finish up by turning to page 307. And here we're talking about planning the bad news message. And first thing is the direct plan on page 307. What you want to do is always, if there's bad news, you got to let them know up front. People hate reading and finally going to the end. You know, you're taking up their time. The anticipation is growing, and then the bad news comes. What you want to do is let them know up front. Example of what not to do. The annual company picnic, originally scheduled for August 3rd at Riverside Park, has been canceled. What we want to say is, because ongoing construction at Riverside Park might present safety hazards to our employees and their families, the annual company picnic, originally scheduled for August 3rd, has been canceled. That's the correct way of doing it. And then finally, on page 310, the indirect plan, where what we want to do is buffer any bad news. You know, because the preceding conditions are not true for many bad news situations, you will often want to use an indirect plan, especially if you're giving bad news to, I always say, first clients, like your shipment isn't going to come this month, or to subordinates, folks under you, readers who prefer the indirect approach, and also readers you don't know. And because what we want to do there is build a relationship. You present the reasons first, then the negative news. You know, this approach emphasizes the reasons for the bad news rather than the bad news itself. So with that, we are pretty much done for today, except for if you would, let's turn to page 315. There's a good little summary. Closing on a pleasant note. You need to end your message on a pleasant note. You don't want to apologize. You don't want to anticipate problems. Don't repeat the bad news over and over again, or repeating a cliche or a doubt, sounding selfish. Make your closing friendly, positive, by using some techniques like best wishes, thank you for your business, we appreciate you doing business with us, and that's what we want to do. Always close on a positive note, and that always brings clients back, builds relationships. Other employees, whether they're peers or subordinates, enjoy working with you, and that's the most important thing. So for next week, we're going to start getting into presentation skills. The next 3 weeks, we're going to spend a lot of time just on presentation skills, building a team presentation, and how to approach the team, you know, as a setting. How do we work together as a team? So look forward to it. Thanks for your time.